Welcome to COVID Chronicles, a podcast by people affiliated with Portland Mennonite Church in Portland, Oregon. The goal of this project is to record stories from PMCers of all ages about how the pandemic is affecting various aspects of their lives. We recognize that while all of us may be in the same ocean, the reality is that each of us is navigating this ocean in our own boat. Our hope is that during this time of physical distancing, these stories will help us to better connect with one another. I'm your host, Gloria Nussbaum, and my first guest is Matt Noel Ching. It feels appropriate that Matt should be my first guest, since he was one of the people who came up with this idea. Matt, it's wonderful to have you. Welcome.
It's great to be here, Gloria. Thanks so much for doing this.
Absolutely. We're going to go back and just get a little bit of detail about your life story. Are you a native Portlander, or what's your beginning story?
So I grew up in California. I'm one of those transplants. And the journey for me was I grew up in Southern California in Orange County. I went to school to college in North Carolina. And then for about 5 years after that, worked in Washington, D.C., doing various projects, some policy work, as well as worked very briefly on a campaign up in New Hampshire. And then I met Megan in 2006. And Megan is from Oregon. She's from Salem. And while there are certain things about D.C. we liked, we both agreed that the place we wanted to settle was back in the West Coast. So in 2006, we packed the car, drove across the country, and we never left.
How did you find PMC, or what's your association there? What are the beginnings of that story?
So I grew up kind of mixed denominationally. So my family's faith journey was kind of interesting. So both my parents grew up in the Seventh-day Adventist Church, which is a church that kind of was founded about the same time as Mormonism, and very theologically very focused on the second coming, but culturally, it's a small but a very tight-knit community. My parents both met at Walla Walla College in Walla Walla, Washington. And so for about the first 5 years of my life, I went to a Seventh-day Adventist church, behind the scenes. I mean, of course, I didn't know this, as a kid. My dad, who was a lawyer, was involved and did some legal work, and some of that legal work didn't make some of the folks in the church, all that happy. And so all of a sudden, I wasn't going to Seventh-day Adventist church anymore. Found myself going to a Presbyterian church for the better part of growing up. And this is back in Southern California. And I think, as I think about how, things were shaped, I definitely appreciate having a church community growing up. When I was in high school, I went through a period where I identified as an evangelical. And that was probably maybe ages, 14 through 18. And there were certain parts of that really resonated with me. I mean, like this deep connection, this deep, personal sense of, okay, I can be connected with God very directly, and so can, folks around me. There were also elements of that, which I think over time, I really kind of questioned. And one of the things that really, during that point, one of the things I think as somebody who's maybe a teenager and, growing up, is that was attractive about that is that, like, here are all the answers, right? and there was some dogma attached to that, but it was also just like, okay, like, you're trying to make sense of the world, you're trying to make connections and figure out, and it was a very linear in my mind. It's like, okay, yes, that's the answer, to this, but there were also some of those rules and some of those answers that I just fundamentally did not agree with. I had friends growing up who were gay, and there was this very open rejection. This is back in the late 90s. And I think over time, I mean, I think I was in college, one day, and there was this, I remember this guy who was like, he was like one of these like strong men for Jesus, and like literally, like he was like a bodybuilder, and he came and did this kind of revival type thing where he like folded, he took a frying pan and he folded it in half. And, it was like, and I was like thinking to myself, I was like, this doesn't, this just doesn't work for me. Like this didn't feel right. And you know, it's like, I mean, I understand everyone's, you know, finding their truth in different ways. But I always was more attracted to spaces where, you know, I was a philosophy major in college. And for me, the questions were always more interesting than the answers. Or I guess over time they became more interesting, and wrestling with those and the journey and the like seeking the truth was more important than like arriving at the answer. And in college, I was part of a Presbyterian fellowship where like we got together every Monday night and like wrestled with all these questions, had super interesting discussions with people. And so when I, after I graduated, I ended up working for Sojourners in Washington, D.C. And that community was, it's a you know, very strong focus on peace and justice and nonviolence. You know, at the time that was right after the run up to the Iraq War. You know, there was it was during the height of the Bush years, and so you know, got involved with some of the anti-war demonstrations there. Ended up working for Howard Dean, who you know had a very quick run for president. I worked for him up in New Hampshire. But while at Sojourners, I connected with a few folks who were part of the Anabaptist tradition. I was like, "What's an Anabaptist? I have no idea what an Anabaptist is." But the, you know, the notion that an expression of our faith, could be rooted in justice and nonviolence and, you know, caring for the earth and caring for one another, it just really resonated. So I think I kind of bookmarked that, away. At the time we were still going to a Presbyterian church in DC, but then when we came to Portland, you know, Megan and I were like, okay, well, where, you know, at the time we didn't have kids, and we're like, okay, where do we want to, be a part of a faith community. And so we went to a few different churches around town. I think more than even theologically, like looking for a specific set of, you know, check boxes, I think we were seeking, what's going to be a great community to have a family and raise kids and share our values. And also just given my, you know, I'm still unpacking a lot of things from the evangelical experience, but also, I mean, just in a very real way, where do we want to bring up our kids where we're not going to mess our kids up, right? Because there's a lot of elements of religion that can be, you know, dangerous or harmful and exclusionary. And so, you know, it went through our mind this, like, you know, gosh, I mean, like, you know, and I remember having coffee at Rod with Panera when it was back next to Trader Joe's and Hollywood back in, I don't know, maybe the late 2000s. I was like, you know, I mean, hey, one of our kids could be gay. How is that gonna, you know, how would we deal with that? And I know we've had some really long conversations as a community about that. You know, and so, but, you know, it was also just, I mean, frankly, you know, amazing to see a church that was where the nursery was full, right? And where there were, young folks who, I mean, at that time, I could not, I would maybe identify as a young person, maybe not at 41 anymore, but, to see, okay, there's a vibrant young, you know, folks and a lot of folks I found, you know, who, grew up in the Mennonite church. A lot of folks who, you know, sort of like me had, you know, an evangelical experience and kind of was like, oh, I don't like that. But I do like the idea of having a strong faith, you know, commitment where we can be in community together. And it was just, it felt like the right community. I don't know any other way to say it. So we never left.
Wow. I'm so fascinated by so many pieces of your story. So I think it sounds like it would be safe to say that God, faith, that kind of thing has always been a part of your life and B, an important part of your life. Is that true?
I think that's true. And that maybe hasn't always like been an expression of like, you know, going to church every Sunday, because there were periods in my life where, you know, like the practice of, you know, going to church, you know, wasn't necessarily like something, but I always, you know, if you could look into my stream of consciousness, like I'm always like thinking about like the bigger, like, you know, why are we here? And what's, you know, what are the things that, you know, connect us? Like how did, like human consciousness, whoa, that's crazy. Like how does that happen? And so there's something out there but also like, not having certainty about what that is, but also, you know, I mean, you know, feeling that like we are spiritually, you know, connected with one another, that we're not just, you know, automata out here, you know, robots, you know, determined by the elements around us, that we have, you know, some choices and why is that? And well, we may never figure it out, but it's a big point of curiosity. And the other thing is that, I mean, I mean the two big commandments, right? I mean, love God and love your neighbor, and especially love your neighbor. I mean, transcending. I mean, over time, I mean, I probably would identify as like less exclusively, like, you know, Christian, or you have to believe these set of principles, you know, to get a certain place, right? You know, I mean, when I was in college, one of my roommates was Jewish, and we had just some of the most amazing, you know, conversations. And you know, I also just, I remember like after September 11th happened, I mean, thinking to myself, like, wow, it's really like, I feel more spiritually connected to people of any religion that had this core of love your neighbor and who could express that both privately and publicly than I did with, I mean, it was just like, whoa, like, okay, like, there are a lot of Bible thumping folks out there that, you know, say that we're worshiping the same Jesus. And I mean, sometimes you even wonder, like, is it the same Jesus that we're wondering, or is it our own? You know, I mean, Jim Wallace, you know, our old boss used to say, you know, and I always think about this, is that, you know, it's like God created us in God's image, and humans return the favor, right? So each human has, you know, their own vision of image of who God is. And I think there's some truth to that. But I also think that, you know, when you extend that, when we're at peace marches and we have folks, you know, from the Jewish community, the Muslim community, and folks who don't identify with any faith, folks who, you know, say, who have been traumatized by religion in various ways, or who just say, like, you know, no, like we can get to love your neighbor through reason. I found connection there as well. So it's complicated, but, you know, that's, I guess, part of where I'm at in my journey right now.
And it sounds like you are somewhat of a political creature as well.
This is going to shock folks. Yeah, I know.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. This is the big reveal here. Do you know when and where and how that got started for you?
Yeah. So, I mean, I grew up in Orange County, California, which at the time was, you know, a pretty, you know, conservative area. And, but, you know, my dad was very active, you know, politically. He was very active in politics. And I think that there were sort of there weren't many, I guess we wouldn't have called them, you know, progressive folks back then, you know, but there was a sort of a tight-knit group of folks who, like, weren't on board with some of where, like that direction of Orange County, you know, was going. And so I remember, like, you know, I was really young, you know, going to, it was like a Jesse Jackson event, you know, back in, you know, 1980. I still have his t-shirt. It's like Jesse Jackson, 1984. Right. You know, but, you know, it's like, you don't really understand, okay, like, you know, what is this? But, you know, I remember like following, you know, elections and things, but I think that love your neighbor as a, in public, is part of, for whatever reason, I don't know, you know, I can't maybe pinpoint exactly why, but that's always been just like a core. That's something I'm just like constantly think about, is like, how do we, and especially like in this moment right now, it's like, okay, like, you know, what if we could reimagine a world in which caring for one another was the highest good, and that we, you know, put aside greed and, you know, materialism and conflict. And, you know, what if we could, you know, say, okay, this is a time where we need to, like, how do we care for our kids? How do we care for our elders? How do we care for the immunocompromised, and work backwards from there? And, you know, how should we redesign? How should we fund things? You know, my family story, like my dad, I talked earlier about, you know, Seventh-day Adventism. And so, I mean, one dimension there was that, you know, my dad is Chinese and my mom is white. My mom grew up in Coos Bay. My dad grew up in Seattle. And, you know, when they met in college, they first got together, my grandparents, particularly my mom's parents, my white grandparents, weren't thrilled at all that, her daughter was, you know, falling in love with this Chinese man. And, just because, I mean, they grew up in Coquille, they grew up in Coos Bay. You know, I didn't know Oregon's history of, you know, racial exclusion, you know, at the time, but they didn't know many people of color. I don't know if they knew any people of color, honestly. You know, let alone, you know, imagine that, you know, you send your daughter off to, you know, a good Christian school and, like, you know, comes back with, you know, this, you know, this Chinese man. So they, you know, over a long period of time, my grandparents, especially my grandfather, after my grandmother passed, had a really powerful reconciling, you know, with my dad. And I, you know, as a kid growing up, I was oblivious to this. And I think my grandparents sort of, like, put that in a bucket and didn't say anything, you know, in front of our faces, certainly. But, you know, at the same time, like, I mean, they had to fight a lot of battles, so that, I mean, my brothers and I, you know, honestly, had to fight fewer battles.
Your parents had to fight a lot of battles for you is what you're saying. And where did the Seventh-day Adventist piece come in? Was that your mother's religion, your father's? What was the story?
It was both. Yeah. All four of my grandparents, were Seventh-day Adventists. So, yeah. Yeah. And so, I mean, you know, that's just one, and I don't think that's necessarily the reason why, but I mean, you think about, loving V. Virginia. I mean, that happened while my parents were making the decision, to get married and, the world we walked in. I mean, when I grew up, I was born in 1979. So you think like, okay, when I arrived in elementary school, Martin Luther King Day was a holiday and we learned about the civil rights movement, what I didn't know at the time, and which I'm still kind of like turning the lights on, like, wow, this is all super recent, right? Is that like that holiday, we were the first, like literally like one of the first sets of kids for whom like this is actually a holiday. We might've been, I don't know if we were the first, maybe 2 or 3 years behind us. And so like in our minds, like, okay, like these are like settled questions, but like, I mean, especially as we get older here, thinking to myself, and I mean, I play this game with Megan all the time and she hates it. she listens to this, but like, the distance in time between events in our lifetime and our kids' lifetime, like, you know, for our generation, the Vietnam War is equidistant in time to how when our kids were born and September 11th. I mean, to them, that's going to feel like history. But it, I mean, to me, in my mind, that happened yesterday, and that is so fresh. And all those feelings like can awaken and be triggered at any moment. With these uprisings that are happening right now, I think put a really fine point on all the work that still needs to be done. It's not settled history; it's living history, and it's this balance between great despair and great hope, in this moment right now.
What a perfect segue, because we are living in a historic time as well, just with regard to this pandemic. I mean, so, and I'm smiling because I lived through the Vietnam War. So, the fact that for you, that's ancient history is, another little reality check for just how things change.
I'm hopeful some of the COVID crime, I would love to hear, especially from folks, in the Mennonite tradition about what was the expression of nonviolence life during, the Vietnam War and other, other conflicts as well. So maybe a next chapter.
Yes, podcasts can do that, can't they? Let's talk a little bit about this virus. Now, we've all been dealing with it since early March, right after my birthday. Everything went to heck.
Oh, wow.
And so that was one of our final family gatherings just before all of this came down. So I'm curious about sort of, first of all, who were you in a bubble with? Who are you in a bubble with? And how did life change sort of your daily life, if at all, during especially these early days of the pandemic?
Life changed very fast. So, so Megan and I are, in our house, it's us and our two kids. And, back in November, we actually went in with Megan's parents and they, had an ADU built in our backyard. And so they're on the premises there. And so that's really fortunate because, they had lived in Salem before. And so you think about like, gosh, if this would have happened even a year ago or so, it would have been a lot tougher to, maintain some community with them. And, we're all figuring out, there's no playbook for this, right? And I remember in the early days, especially, like it was really hard figuring out, okay, like what are we supposed to do right now? And so, early on, I think the first week when schools were closed, the kids were going back and forth to the grandparents' house, and then every week, this is just back in March, it was I think the gravity of things, this is I feel silly saying this, now, but I think one of the markers for me that like, okay, this is real and something is really different and this is going to be, was when I heard like the NCAA basketball tournament was going to be played without fans. And then 24 hours later, it's like, no, we're not playing it at all. The NBA season got canceled. I mean, it wasn't just like, okay, like, business is closed. It's like, okay, there's a gravity there. And I feel silly that like, it took like something in sports to like, kind of like shake, but that was, we're all living through this. I've never been alive during a pandemic of this scale.
So and neither has anybody else.
No, neither has anybody else. Right.
And I think the piece that we sometimes forget is it's not just us. It's not just Oregon. It's not just the US. It's the world. And that's another piece that makes it so historic.
Yes. And so, yeah, we're all connected by this thing, like you said, and I like the opening you said about in the same ocean, but in different boats. One of my coping mechanisms earlier, call it a coping, I don't know what, it was something that I did was I would just like read tons about the data and sometimes become despondent, but also just trying to figure out like what's going on. That did not make me the most popular person in our household. Just cause I'm like, I was the person, I never microwaved the mail, but I insisted we open the mail outside and, it's this balance between we want to control the controllable, but also realizing that at a certain point, we're not in control. This virus is in control, and we've got to take the precautions that we can that are smart. But over time, I think as we've realized, okay, this is going to last a while. So you asked about like our bubble. One of the I struggle with talking about like silver linings about this because there's 130,000 plus people who've died. This is probably going to be the biggest. Well, hopefully, it's the biggest tragedy. At least so far in our lifetimes, in terms of that scale of death and suffering, and we don't know what the long term consequences here. Hyper locally, having the kids, staying home, the kids have developed these great friendships, in the neighborhood where kids can bike outside, and so for summertime, there's a family down the street, and there's two kids that are Abe's age, and they'll just hop on their bikes, hop on their scooters, and they can. Hanging outside all day, and it's trying to figure out. I think we're all trying to figure out. Okay, how do we maintain human connections in ways that are safe, but also that there's our mental health too. I shared early on, I also I live with depression, and that can be activated at any point. Sometimes it just going through a day, I'll be having a really good day, and then. Hear something on the news or something, will happen and just like kind of overcome with, sadness or despair and can lock up. That can be a challenge, personal wise, work wise and things. Like you said, we're all sort of on top of each other too. And so every day is a little bit different, but big picture, grateful that both Megan and I are able to work from home, and we're fortunate to be able to work in, places where we're able to keep our jobs. So, that's been, very, very grateful, for that. I think, multiple things can be true. Like we're very grateful, and it's still, challenging in many, many ways. So.
And do I recall correctly that you changed jobs in the middle of the pandemic?
Yeah, that's correct. I had been working at Partners for Hunger Free Oregon, and now work at Oregon Food Bank. I started that job on April 1st. The original plan was, because my, so I'm, and, I do legislative work. So I'm essentially their public policy, like their lobbyist. Just following the legislative calendar, I think this feels like 10 years ago, right? But like there was, when there was a walkout in the legislature,
we're talking the state legislature, just to clarify.
The state legislature. That's right. Okay. This was like late February. Maybe even if I could back up before then, we had this agreement to do this job transition at the beginning of April, because we thought this would be, we'd be entering into quiet season where not much would be happening, because the state legislative session was supposed to end in early March, and it was supposed to be fairly straightforward. And then, of course, that blew up. And then we were supposed to be entering into sort of a quiet season, where we could just sort of build some long-term work. And then, of course, the global pandemic hit. So nothing, at least in that, went according to plan. Yeah, having said that, it was also at a time when, April 1st, the first week that I was at my new job, we had a meeting with the governor to talk about, okay, how can emergency food respond at this time of, great need. That was early April. So, that was right when, tens of thousands of layoffs were happening, in Oregon. Probably 100, I remember what the latest, numbers are. I remember, at the beginning, we saw Northeast Emergency Food Pantry saw 10 times the number of people asking for food. And we were really trying to figure out, okay, how are we going to do this? Because the entire food banking sector had to change our model of, no longer can people go inside to, pick out, you know, food. It's, I mean, so we had to do boxes, and I mean, you've probably seen this on the news where people drive up and okay, you just load a box in your trunk. Used to be that you do these long intake forms, you know, asking folks questions. There's no more intake. It's just, you know, like if you're showing up to get food, you need food. So, so, you know, here's the box of food here. But, and also just, I mean, it was really challenging because, and it continues to be, because we're all trying to, you know, fly this airplane as we're building it, as it were, in terms of like, because I mean, you know, even like, okay, the state early on, you know, Governor Brown, was able to allocate and get some money from FEMA to help with emergency food in Oregon. Which, and so it ended up being about $1 million a week. And one of the challenges that we found was that it was more challenging than you thought to actually purchase food right now, because I mean, there were some of the disruptions, you know, that were happening, but, and so like restaurant industries, for example, like didn't have, or food suppliers that supplied restaurants were having, their markets, you know, dry up. The challenge is that it's, you know, if you're producing, you know, let's just say seafood, for restaurants, you know, that seafood, you know, might be still being caught, but to actually process that in a way that could end up in a food box is, there's many, many layers of challenges that is just, it's not a straight line between like, okay, we're now, you know, giving a check and then a week later, you know, there's food, right? It ended up being a lot more complicated on that. Unfortunately, there were a lot of the food banks and you know, a lot of the food producers who were able to get pretty creative. I mean, sometimes it was just like a local food bank partnering with a small farm to purchase, you know, eggs or, you know, I mean, there was a lot of creativity that was happening. And so it's been both encouraging to see folks adapt. I mean, there's at least at this point right now, we're not, the food bank is not in a position where we're saying no to people who are, you know, coming seeking food. But then you think about all the kids who, you know, when school got out, are missing school meals. And so we did a lot of work in partnership to, and there was some federal money that now allows kids to get meals, I mean, essentially grocery money instead of school meals. Maybe that's the simplest way of saying that. That took longer than we had hoped to get rolling, but now it's at least in the process of being rolling. And as we march toward schools reopening right now, we're going to need Congress to enact that, to re-up on that, to make sure that continues right now. Because that's another thing that just gives me, you know, a lot of heartache right now, is what's going to happen with schools in the fall. So, so many challenges ahead, and we're just trying to, you know, like, both move from crisis to crisis and at the same time put ourselves in a position where we can reimagine a brighter future once we're on the other side of this.
So is it safe to say that the job that you thought you were getting or taking turned out to be just a bit different than what you initially thought?
Yeah, that's pretty accurate. Because I don't mean to make light of that. It's just, it's just a lot. Yeah.
Because generally you would be an advocate for in the legislature for the food bank, but now it sounds like there were a lot of other things the food bank simply had to do to get
right
up and running in this new pandemic. And there you were. So
maybe yeah,
they pulled you in.
Yeah. Maybe one of the ways of saying it is that there are, you know, while some of the is, sometimes legislative things are a mess, usually there are some predictable rhythms to how it works. Okay. Like we know on the calendar, the state's supposed to meet here. Congress is supposed to meet at these times. And that just got completely blown up. And you know, whereas, I think, we had to shift and we had planned that my role was going to be primarily focused on, you know, state level work. I've ended up working a lot more closely with our federal delegation. Actually, got a, you know, was able to connect with you know, Julia, you know, Stafford. we meet you know, occasionally just because, you know, she's on she's still with Congressman Schrader, and we're, you know, because I mean, the way the state budgeting works, the state has to balance its budget, and in times of recession, times like these, you see tax revenues drying up, and you see needs increasing. And so to the degree that our structures can respond to greater need, that's got to be done at the federal level, at least in terms of resources, because the federal, you know, government can run deficits. And so so we made the decision to focus a lot of our energy on, you know, trying to, you know, really ensure that our delegation is doing everything they can to make sure that families have resources, you know, to put food on the table, to keep income, to make sure that folks can continue to cannot lose can continue to stay in their homes, because I mean these challenges are just immense, even just in the next month or so, I mean this is July 16th when we're recording this. We're hoping that Congress is going to pass a stimulus in the next couple of weeks. And after that, the state's going to figure out, okay, what's in that? Got to do the analysis and figure out, okay, what are the remaining needs? What are the remaining gaps? And may have to, enact some cuts as well. And we want to make sure that when those cuts happen, that we're asking questions. I mean, we're the ones holding accountability. And I mean, not just we, but I mean, we Food Bank, but you know, many folks in partnership. How are we applying a racial justice lens? How are we ensuring that people who are harmed the most right now aren't going to be suffering the impacts of these cuts? Is there room to ask, there are still people doing well. I mean, you could, not just Jeff Bezos, but I mean, there are still people doing well during this pandemic. Maybe folks who are doing well ought to be asked to contribute a little bit more. And maybe, so those are some of the questions that we're asking, right now. And it's, so yeah, it's definitely been a roller coaster, but also grateful to be able to be doing this work, and we do have some good allies along the way.
Well, it's obvious that there are so many more stories that we can't get to today, but let me just say on behalf of everyone in the congregation that we are glad that there's someone of your stature and of your background and with your moral compass and your love and care for humanity in the role that you are in and working with our state and national legislators. That is a real gift to all of us. And so on behalf of the congregation, I just want to say thank you to you, Matt.
Thank you, Gloria. That's kind of you to say.
And as I said, we're pretty much out of time, so we'll have to bring you back for session 2. Thank you so much for taking the time, Matt, to share these stories with us.
Thank you so much, Gloria. I'm so thrilled that this project is taking off. And just a pitch for folks in the congregation, I hope you can do this too. I would love to hear from as many folks. It's just, I think more than anything else, what I crave right now is human connection. And I listen to a lot of podcasts while doing dishes and laundry. And so I'm hoping this can be a way that we can stay connected. So grateful for you doing this, Gloria.
And thank you for joining us for this episode of COVID Chronicles. We hope you discovered something new and feel connected to your friends at Portland Mennonite. Stay safe, and until next time, I'm Gloria Nussbaum.